You know, we talk about what an individual can do and what a church can do, and you use that beautiful metaphor of the musical instruments. I was thinking, just as you were speaking, about a person that I met by doing a podcast with him on Hank Unplugged not long ago. His name is Tristan Osbe. He's the only government official in the world with aid to persecuted Christians in his title. He's a state secretary for Hungary. And here you have a country unabashedly Christian that is rebuilding churches in Iraq that were destroyed by ISIS, giving aid to the poorest of the poor in sub-Saharan Africa. And I'm thinking about all of the possibilities if Christians really take their commission seriously, the Great Commission that Christ gave to us. Pretty important words. The end of Matthew 28, the last words, and lo, I'm with you always, even to the ends of the earth. If governments can take that seriously, and individuals like I describe can take that seriously, and people like you that founded a ministry, GFA World, that is literally maybe the second largest ministry, maybe the largest mission in the world, I don't know, but very large, doing a tremendous amount of work. I've seen it personally. I know, but I guess I'm bringing these examples up for you to elaborate on, because this commission is not an impossible commission. I oftentimes use an example. You know, we're talking about orthodoxy. The numbers fluctuate. Some people say that there are 250 million. Some people say there are 300 million Orthodox in the world. And I just use that as an example, the Orthodox world. Think if only 10% of the Orthodox world would take seriously the commission of Christ and would bring one person into the fullness of the Orthodox church life in 1 year. Well, then that particular year, if it was 2021, we'd have 50 million committed people who are evangelistic, who are mission-minded. If that happened the next year, you'd have 100 million. And if you extrapolate that out through the principle of spiritual multiplication, in less than 7 years, you'd reach the world. I sometimes say tongue-in-cheek, we'd fight over pagans. We'd say, that's mine, I saw him first. If you take that same example and only 1% of committed Orthodox believers, 1% would bring one person into the life of the church in 1 year, and you extrapolate that same spiritual multiplication principle out, it'll take less than 12 years to reach the world. That's the power inherent in spiritual multiplication. So why don't we do it? Well, I think you've sort of enumerated that. We have our health, we have our wealth, we have our altars, we have our churches, and we're at ease while the world perishes.
Of course, looking at my life and your life, or Dr. Nathan or George Burrow or anybody, actually, sometime in our life there was an encounter, either a dream or a vision or people or community or going vacation or whatever. For me, it was the slums of Mumbai that had a huge impact on my life. And this is what we've been doing here, GFA World. We invite young people, when they finish their high school, if they can take a year off their life and come and be here in this community. We can accommodate up to 200 young people, and we have been doing that for quite a long time. And we have young people that been through this 1 year of, it's a community where they learned to live for Christ, not just theological education only. And because you learn to pray not by reading books about it, you learn to pray by praying. And you learn about fasting not by reading about it, but actually participating in the community of the body of Christ without force or legalized systems. And we have young people now in Thailand, in North Korea, and all kind of places that 1 year turned the world upside down. So I would say, you know, those of us who believe Christ and the authentic faith of the church, we offer this amazing opportunity. We don't make money on them. They come here for 1 year, and out of that few weeks, they go overseas. And because Matthew 9, it says, when Jesus saw the multitude, he was moved with compassion, and he had his disciples with him to experience it. So I would say, wherever possible, seminaries, mother churches and all that, they should actually embrace younger generation to mentor and communicate and help them to see the world. And I would say, how do we translate these things into the lives of people? I think the future of Western Christianity is absolutely in the hand of the very young generation, age 13 through 25. And we have to figure out how they're going to touch God, not just memorize things. And I think, you know, your children, I know about them, their journey with God, it's not because Hank Hanegraaff is the most brilliant theologian or speaker, although you are, but they journeyed in the road that you journeyed on, and this is true of a lot of people. And you know, I don't know, Dr. Nathan, all about you, but little I know about you, you can't imagine how many people's lives are influenced by your and your wife taking that little, you know, child as your own that nobody want in the world. And so what, somehow we had to communicate with living reality these truths. And I, you know, I keep thinking, I'm, you know, in this I'm very American, that is pragmatic. I think practically, how do you translate all this? And my request to you is that if we can tell the whole world and their families, why don't you look into this, our website, and see the, you know, School of Discipleship for 1 year. Mm-hmm. And we don't make one penny out of them. I mean, as a matter of, we try to find resources. They don't have, you know, the $2,900 something like that takes for the whole year. Mm-hmm. For them to live here and experience life. And some of our most faithful people are people who went through this 1 year. We model this after Jesus and his disciples, that they learned what it means to be, you know, his by being with him. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we are not perfect. I mean, far from it. But, you know, we are struggling people learning what it means to follow the Lord. Mm-hmm. And so I assigned you as a metropolitan. Go and tell everybody to send their... Sorry.
Well, if I can make an endorsement of that. So, you know, obviously, becoming truly human, I did all this research on the nuns, and you always have to say N-O-N-E-S, not Catholic nuns, right? Religiously unaffiliated. One of the problems that always came out, and it came out again and again for them, they mentioned the problem of evil, but the one that was always there, and they were articulating it, but they didn't know it was a formal philosophical problem, is the problem of divine hiddenness. Mm-hmm. This sense that if God is real, and it's important that I believe in him, he has an obligation to make it clear to me that he's real. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. And why doesn't he make himself more evidently present? And many of them, when you listen to their stories and what shakes them and begins to say, I don't know, maybe... Well, since most of them don't reject God, maybe God is just not personal, you know. Maybe he's the cosmos, maybe he's, you know, it's either deism or pantheism, something like that. It's oftentimes a story of unanswered prayer. It's a story of horrible things happening, and God could have shown up and should have shown up and didn't show up. And this is where I would tie this back with something that we talked about earlier about synergy. Is that because of a certain mindset that we have about how God acts in the world, we think of him as just another agent in the world. And so if we're interacting here and there's not suddenly, you know, a God orb that shows up between us, God isn't here, as opposed to the concept of synergy, the idea that you are supposed to be a conduit for divine energy, and you are supposed to be a conduit for divine energy, and I'm supposed to be a conduit of divine energy. Gregory of Nyssa actually says, when he's talking about this idea of divine vision and where you see God, he actually says, you see it in yourself when you take on the divine attributes, which is a crazy statement, right? He's talking about that you being energized by God, and that's really God in you. And when you see that, when you recognize that happening, you're actually seeing God. Or alternatively, when I see it in KP, right, then I recognize it's not just KP, right? It's KP and God synergistically. And the reason I think this is important is because there are two things that what you're proposing address, and you know whether they work, I don't know, but one thing is just getting the younger generation to get out of themselves, right? Social media and a lot of things about our life and culture is very egocentric. It's about me, and oftentimes the question is, how do you shake someone out of that and make them look outside of themselves? And obviously the sort of context that you're proposing, that's the sort of thing that oftentimes will wake somebody up that there are other things going on than just whatever I've got going on with myself. And the other thing is, it gives them an opportunity when they say, where is God, to see it in people like you doing that work on the ground. And I think in that sense, it addresses that problem of divine hiddenness that is one of the main problems that so many of the younger generation who step away, become disillusioned, what they're really looking for. They're looking for that, where is God? And if you can shift that lens and they can understand synergy, they can understand that, you know, giving a cup of cold water to somebody who's thirsty actually does represent a synergistic act. You offer them an opportunity to answer the question, where is God? It's in this person who's doing this thing.
By the way, I saw the movie you did.
Becoming truly human.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure who are watching this, you know, discussion we have, and I think there's no way we are able to cover all the grounds and massive amount of information out there from Hank Hanegraaff podcast and teachings and all that, and I wish everyone watched that, your movie, and I think they should put it up on the screen so people can go and watch it, which is very, very significant. As a matter of fact, I was stunned in the sense I was like in despair a little bit. My goodness, this is unreal. This is really happening. You know, the questions people are asking you, and I mean, you're absolutely brilliant the way you handle it. I would lose my temper, I think.
But how do you take what you did in that movie, Becoming Truly Human, how do you take someone that says, you know what, the one thing Nathan didn't do in that movie is preach the gospel to those nuns and convert them? There would have been some satisfaction in that movie if you had converted at least one of them.
Hank,
you
know? He's smarter than us.
So in your documentary, in your movie, Becoming Truly Human, you don't do that. Mm-hmm. But at the end, there's a mosaic that comes together, and that mosaic really is emblematic of the church life, which is not church, but a life, church life. Ecclesia is church life. Mm-hmm. Can you, in capsulized form, explain what you're doing in that movie? Because that movie is a representation of where most of American youth is going.
Yeah.
That's why it's important. Mm-hmm. And how the mosaic ties everything together. So rather than necessarily a gospel message, you're communicating how the end for all of us is church life. This is why Metropolitan K.P. Yohanan has founded so many churches, and we talk about 12,000 churches. I mean, I know that's a modest number, because you want to you know, understate rather than overstate. But new churches are being born as we speak. What was the number that you were talking about just the other?
We can't even keep up with it in the sense of people. I think the Lord's coming is close, and I think he's gathering people to himself. And it's...
So I would say that a big part of what that film was is it was born out of... it was born out of genuine compassion and understanding for the religiously unaffiliated. I mean, you've talked about the way Orthodoxy helped you to sort of lay aside the tendency to judge other people. And really, there's no way to read the monastics and the way they talk about other people. Seraphim Rose tells you to imagine every person to be an angel and make excuses for them and presume that they're, you know, that they're saintly and that you're the worst of sinners. And that's just sort of pervasively in the way that they see people. And so for myself, as someone who looks at the nuns and hears their questions, hears their objections, and says, yeah, I identify with every one of those. I went through that same journey myself. How on earth could I ever pass judgment on any one of them for being there? Right? I was there, and I needed, you know, I needed the time, I needed patience, you know. And so the entire way I framed the film was built around an understanding, a compassion and empathy for the nuns. So when I first proposed the film, what I proposed is I said, I think you have to do a couple of things when engaging the nuns. You know, the one is you have to just humanize them and let them be vulnerable people who have real stories and real struggles and real fears and anxieties and real questions. And the best way to do that is to just do cinematic portraits where you let them say who they are and where they've come from without any judgment, without anything else. And I said, and in terms of opening up discussion, you have to understand many of them don't talk about religion. And they don't talk about religion because who are they going to talk to, right? If my mom's upset that I don't go to church anymore, I mean, am I going to talk to her? All she's going to do is express her fears and worries and the need for me to go back to church. Do I talk to my atheistic roommate who's just as dogmatic, but he's going to tell me that I shouldn't believe in God at all? So who do I talk to? And I found that most nuns don't talk to anybody about religion ever. So they have all of this existential baggage inside and no one to talk to about it. So I said, well, probably the best way to get them to talk and open up is to get them to talk to each other, people who will identify with them. And then, of course, the film also shares my own journey because I'm trying to offer a long view on the nuns and saying just because this is where they're at doesn't mean their journey's over. I mean, they're on a journey. It's incomplete. They're young, right? You know, and so everything about how I interacted with them was without judgment. And in fact, none of them knew I was Orthodox. So when I talked to them and interviewed them as a director, all they knew is I was the director of the film. They knew there'd be this other story about some nun who ended up becoming Orthodox eventually. And I said, I didn't tell them that was me, though. And what was so surprising to me that emerged out of that is I'd take them out to dinner and I'd interview them as a potential candidate for the film. I just asked them the same questions I asked them in the film. You know, were your parents religious? Both of them, just one? How often did you go to church? Was it cultural? Was it not? When was the first time you started to doubt, you know, Christianity? Whatever it was, right? And I just listen and ask follow-up questions because I wanted to know. And at some point the guard lowered because they said, well, he's not... They kept on waiting for the sales pitch, and there was no sales pitch. I was just there listening to their story, and no one ever listened to their story. And something that I found so unexpected was after so many of the interviews, they would come up and thank me for the opportunity to talk about this because they never get to talk to anybody about it. I thought, well, that's
Well, you know, when I watched that, I never met you, mm-hmm. but I said to myself, this is, I mean, looked at all the faces, their eyes, you know, different people that you had, young people, and the impression I got in the end was, who are these Dr. Nathan Jacobies? He said to each one, they are good, they are, there is hope and a lot of encouragement just by the way you are doing it. And I realize how desperate people are for acceptance. And whether you realize it or not, that I try to think, what did you do? What is magic about this whole thing? And I think it was truly without judgmentalism, you embrace them, which was very, very significant. I think everybody should watch it.
Mm. Well, and the other thing that emerged out of that was that a lot of them kept on wanting to know what I think. Now, the irony was, as the director who didn't want to taint, you know, poison the well, I'd say, oh, don't worry what I think, you know, I'm just the I want to know what you think. So there was this barrier. I couldn't get myself to ever cross that line. And they just became more curious, right? What on earth do you think? I want to know what you think. And I always reference this one story, Eric, which was the guy with the ponytail who tried like every religion under the sun. He came up to me one day on set after he'd done his interview. He said, I snuck a look at, he's from, you know, he had this thick accent. He said, I snuck a look at the call sheet and I discovered you're the secret believer. And he said, man, I want to go out for a beer with you because I want to know how on earth you got from where I am to where you are. And we've talked. I mean, I haven't kept up tabs on most of them, and that was, you know, there's a variety of reasons for that. But I think there's a lesson, an important set of lessons in just how to engage people.
Yeah.
And in terms of the ending, I mean, you talked about the mosaic. There's also the closing scene, which is my favorite of the entire film. There's certain parts of the film that make me weep, which is weird since I made it, but they do.
Make you literally weep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of them is the segment on Bojar, but... you know, there's a mosaic that emerges.
You're talking about your son there.
Yeah, my son. I talk about us adopting him and his background story, and essentially how he's a metaphor, right, for that icon, right, of God that's been cast aside and left for dead, and our desire. That is a small glimpse, maybe the one time in my life where maybe I did something that was Christ-like, I don't know. Although even that's probably tainted. But throughout the entire film, there's a collage being built, right? So there's this working metaphor as I'm sharing my own story. You know, I talk about, you know, my dad and pull out photos of my dad and I cut them up and I glue them up there. And I won't blow it for anybody who happens to not have seen it, but at some point that collage comes together and you see it makes an image, right? And the image obviously converges with my own story, and the whole point is to say, you know, in some ways all these disparate pieces that don't seem to make any sense mm-hmm. at some point in the providence of God start to make sense. And that's really what I was advocating for the nuns. I mean, their stories are incomplete. I don't think there's anything invalid about what they're struggling with or asking or anything like that. I identify with all of it. But also in terms of the closing scene in the film, there's several things going on there. I go on the street with this backdrop, you know, this halo backdrop, and I start taking footage of random people from the street standing in front of it as if they look like Byzantine icons, right? Like saints, canonized saints. And the scene has not a single word in it, right? It's all silent, except for the one hymn that's playing. It's a funeral hymn. I don't know how many people know that. But it's a funeral hymn because it has to do with this sort of imitation of the death of God, right? Referring to St. Ignatius and the quote that the film's taken from, right? Becoming truly human. And there's it's a layered set of images, and I hate to overexposit it and remove any force, but I'll just say that at least one of the things that's there is the recognition that in every person, wherever they're at, there's both a certain level of tragedy and the loss of that likeness of God, right? The disrupting of the creation of man. When you see that, right? When you see what's supposed to be. But there's also that inescapable hope that that icon can't be destroyed. And that's what they're made to be, and they may well become that.
I want to talk about something I alluded to earlier when I was talking about Tristan Osbe. So a couple of things. What I was talking about with respect to persecution of Christians. When I was talking to Tristan Osbe, he was communicating that 8 out of 10 persecuted people in the world are Christians, 80%. Many different ways of communicating that number. I want to talk for just a few moments. Let's spend maybe 2 or 3 minutes on persecution and how the church was forged in persecution and how we today in Western civilization are facing persecution. I said to Tristan, it's not, he grew up under, you know, in Hungary, was under communist rule. He said persecution, we often talk about hard and soft persecution, but the kind of the persecution we're going through in the West doesn't mean, because you're not thrown into a gulag, doesn't mean it's soft persecution. You may lose your job, you may lose your reputation. What's your view of how the church forged in persecution actually spreads more rapidly?
Well, it's always been, what is it, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church, right? And, I mean, heaven forbid I compare job loss to, you know, the shedding of my blood, like St. Ignatius being, you know, fed to lions or something like that.
That's exactly what happened.
Right. But it's, I mean, that shouldn't be, I think at the end of the day, there is an importance to the fact, there's a testimony to the fact that a person really believes these things. There's, putting aside, I don't know if you like or don't like Jordan Peterson, right? But he's a controversial character. But one thing I remember, he was being interviewed and somebody asked him about the fact that he doesn't like to answer the question, do you believe in God, right? And he talked about why he doesn't like to answer that question. And I thought his response was actually rather profound, because he essentially said, if I really believed in God, then my life should look a certain way. And so I find it a very difficult thing to claim that I believe in God if my life doesn't look that way. And I'm very sympathetic to that. And I think with the martyrs, with the early Christians, it was always a testimony. You can say that you, this world, that you're a pilgrim here, that this world isn't the be-all, end-all, that you're different than the pagans, that, you know, you live for something that's eternal and not temporal. But if nothing in your life indicates that, it's not much of a testimony to that. And so putting aside whether the persecution is hard or soft, I think the common thread that runs through it that's important is that how we act in some ways becomes a testimony to what we believe or what we don't believe.
You yourself have faced persecution.
Yeah, the scripture says all those who want to be godly or reflect God's life through us will suffer persecution. As far as I can see from the Old Testament, New Testament history of the church, it is not somebody beating you up physically and robbing you of your wealth and this and that. Suffering is, we actively embrace the cross. If somebody cannot fast one day of the week for the sake of a dark, dying world and neighborhood, how can they face stoning and house burned down? So the free world we are in, I say, let's learn to embrace inconvenience and suffering and don't wait for somebody to come and shoot us. If that is not there, I mean, I asked a preacher long ago, he spent 35 hours studying for his half hour, 40 minutes teaching in the Sunday, and normally he does that. I asked him how much time he pray, and he wouldn't answer in the end because he was, I know him very well. He said, I'm ashamed to tell you, not even half hour. So what I'm saying, like, you know, the Coptic Orthodox Christians, they line them up, 30, 40 people, and ask one question. You confess their God and deny. And I watch them. You can see on YouTube this. Not a word they say, and their heads are cut off. I mean, even just right now, news being released about a 60-year-old Coptic an Orthodox Christian kneeling down, they cut his head off. And why? Their faith and their life is not segregated. It's one and the same. So if, I mean, if they kill us, what, I mean, honestly, what is the most amazing thing? We can be with Christ. And that is a pure Orthodox faith. So whether we are in prison or beaten up or whatever, I think the embracing of the suffering is a choice we make, not somebody imposing on us. And these Christians are willing. I can tell you about 14 sisters I know living on the mission field that I know personally, all their husbands were murdered for preaching the gospel. But some of their wives are raising their children to take the place of their husbands. I mean, they were not going out, kill me, no. But their hearts were already given to Christ. There's nothing he can do. How can he kill somebody who's dead? And this is the Christianity here, everywhere. I mean, I'm not talking about America or Europe, and all over the world. I mean, China, when the communists took over, they said maybe there are, you know, less than 1 million Christians in the country. But the bamboo curtain was raised, and all of a sudden, it is estimated no less than 70 million followers of Christ in the country that through suffering and death and pain, like much money and his followers and others. So they were refined in difficulties. But here in the Western world, I think we are losing everything because we don't want to embrace suffering. And that's what my encouragement would be.
Well, we'll end with that. I mean, it has been an honor to spend these hours with you as the Metropolitan of a very large body of believers in the 1040 window and elsewhere, and the founder of GFA World. It's been an honor to spend time with you. We've had a lot of time to spend together as friends and as co-workers in Christ, and I appreciate your work academically. I also appreciate the gift God has given you in filmmaking, and maybe we'll end by simply quoting the words of our Lord, who said, "Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you." You've experienced that. "On account of me, rejoice and be glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you."